I've forgotten it now, but there was one instant when everything fell into place and made sense, and I said aloud, "Oh, of course. Why didn't I see all this before? Why couldn't I have realized all these things and not resisted them so much?" That didn't last and hasn't recurred. There was a witch who was very kind and sent out the best warm and lovely vibrations. She was wearing red velvet, and she's an older lady, really a witch in the best possible way. I was glad she was there, and she was smiling and understanding and enjoying, mothering those few who were not reacting well. There was one girl who was wrestling with God. She was with friends, and I think she was all right after a few hours. There was one man who became completely withdrawn. I want to say catatonic, because we tried to bring him out of it and could not make contact at all. He was sort of a friend of mine, and I had some responsibility for getting him back to town. He had a previous history of mental hospitals, lack of contact with reality, etc. And when I realized what had happened, I begged him not to drink the Kool-Aid, but he did. And it was very bad. These are the only two people I know of who did have bad experiences, but I'm sure I wasn't in contact with everyone. I told you about the tape recording. Who cares? I don't care. And how it was used again at the next one. Showbiz. Showbiz, yes and no. Claire was soaring on LSD, wondering what was happening to herself and whether she was going mad and so forth, and the most crazed scream rang out, "Who cares?" And then, "Ray! Ray! Who cares?" Not even such a manic scream could have been heard over the general roar and rush of the test ordinarily, over the Grateful Dead wailing, or certainly not with such clarity, except for that fact that it was being picked up by a microphone and amplified out of huge theater horns. Who cares? That was just the thing for somebody like Claire to hear, Claire who thought she was going mad. The sound of a woman freaking out, blowing her mind, all of it amplified as if it were tearing out of every gut in the place and up through every brain. So Claire's protector and impromptu guide put his arms around her again and told her, "It's a tape they made. It's just a put-on. Hugh Romney made it." Well, that seemed plausible. Hugh was an actor and a great satirist and put-on artist and prankster. In fact, between screams, there was Hugh's voice, sure enough, coming over the microphone. "Ladies and gentlemen, there's a cop who's come apart in the next room. Will somebody go in there and put that cop back together again? Ray! Ray! It's too perfect!" Then Romney's voice coming back in. "Does anybody have any tranquilizers? There's somebody having a little trouble in the next room." The next room was the anteroom off the big hall that Claire had started out in. There was a girl in there sitting on the floor and freaking out in the most complete way. Just the thing for acid veterans. These things happen. What you need is... And pranksters and other hierophants of the acid world heard about the girl sitting in there and screaming, "Who cares?" and freaking out. Norman Hartwig and Romney came in there. And here was a fairly pretty girl, if only her face wasn't so contorted, with one crippled leg, shrieking, "Who cares?" and "Ray!" Ray, the very Ray himself, and Romney looks at Ray and sees the picture at once. Ray is a big guy with a crew cut and a T-shirt and a sleeveless jacket or vest or something on, which shows his muscles very well. He looks like some sailor who fell in with a bunch of hippies, and now he wonders what in the fuck has happened. "Ray!" The worst possible guy in the world to deal with the "Who Cares" girl. This is a job for experts, and we have them here, some of the greatest acid experts in the world. Romney, Norman, the Hassler. He comes in. And here comes Babs, and they're all gathered around her in a bunch. "Attention, remember Rachel Wrightbread." And it came to pass. And they give her the freak-out expertise. Don't fight it. Go with it. Neither accept nor deny. Go with the flow. We're with you. You're in the hands of experts. Experts. And the pranksters are there rapping over her, riff after riff of words. And then Romney got hold of some Thorazine, a tranquilizer that is good at aborting bad LSD trips, and he says, "Here, take this. Take this." The Who Cares girl and Ray look at this costumed freak amid a group of costumed freaks, all zonked, trying to hand her a capsule of God knows what. Diabolism. And Ray throws the Thorazine away, and the Who Cares girl throws it away. The capsules go skidding across the floor, and the Who Cares girl goes, "A-rump-a-rump-a-rump-a-rump." rumpa rumpa hoo ha hoo ra rumpa, mumbling along, drifting in and out of the freak out, giggling for a stretch, and they say, ah, she's coming out of it, and then, who cares? Ray! Ray! Oh, what's the use? Sex! Ray! Sex! Who cares? That phrase, it sticks in Romney's head. He can't get it out. Her scream shrieks over the hall because now Babs has brought up a microphone and holds it near her, right in front of Ray, solicitously, like this will do it. Ray's head sprockets around inanely. Babs is getting it all over the microphone to make it part of the test. Not an isolated event, but all one, anachoretic freakout. Who cares? Romney looks at Babs and, who cares? Well, Babs cares, with one part of him, but with another his devotion is to the test, to the archives. A freakout for the archives, freaked out on tape in the archives, who cares in the prankster archives, and the cry wails over the hall into every brain, including Claire's. Romney can't get this insane cry out of his head, who cares, and it becomes the who cares test for him, and he is back at the microphone with his mission now, his voice furrowing into the microphone. Listen, this girl's brains are coming out, and who cares? This girl's coming apart, and who cares? This girl's breaking up into crispy chips, and who cares? This girl's caked in the dust, nylon wall to wall on her eyeballs, and who cares? And it was very clear. Everybody who cared would do something, pour on the energy, if nothing else, bleed dimensional cremo for her, if they truly cared. It became a test for Romney, he could feel it, to find the depths of how much he cared. Who cares? She shrieks. He cares. He feels it and feels himself growing, while the tapes reel it all in. Finally, even at the Watts test, they wear down, and those who are not into the pudding begin to drift off, and the prankster diehards and a few discoverers like Claire Brush are still there. And Norman can tell it is coming, the magic hour, and Hassler gets up in a blue pageboy costume and does a funny, beautiful slow dance to the music that is just perfect. And Paige is working behind him with the projectors, the film projectors and the slide projectors, and he sets up a really kind of gorgeous collage, moving projections on top of still projections. And the pranksters sit amazed and delighted, and he makes slow changes, abstract patterns and projections from the slides, and it all fits together. Everything. About 6 a.m., more cops, narcos now, six in plain clothes, and one of the diehard 3 o'clock discoverers walks up to them and announces with a look of total acid-stoned, glistening sincerity, "Listen, I've got more awareness in my little fingernail. My awareness is so superior to yours that, obviously, from the glistening strain on his face, there is no metaphor, no conceit, that can be concocted in the English language that is enormous enough to express just how superior." And so his face falls back into a sweet, sincere look, slightly played out, and he says, "How about getting us some cigarettes? We're all out." Strangely, one of them did, and returned very quickly with a carton of Cools, which he passed around. Around 9 a.m., only the pranksters, Claire and a few others, are still around. And more cops. And finally, they say to Babs that he ought to get everybody out now. The L.A. sun is up. The good spades of Watts are going to work. And the pranksters troop out into the L.A. sunlight, the devil with an orange face with silver stars, a tall, wild-haired guy with half his face silver and half gold, day-glow crazies trooping out into the sunlight at 9 a.m. out of the chilled pandemonium hatchery. And Claire Brush, "It seems that's about it. I've rambled incredibly. Did it last? Am I different? I can't remember. It seems so, but I'm not sure. When I get under black light or a strobe, it comes back vividly." Del Close told me later I was wandering around looking wonderful in the sense of full of wonder. That's the best description I can imagine. I've taken LSD twice since then. Each time was different and much less dramatic, more personal, milder. The only strong similarity is the physical effect, which, for me, consists of contractions quite like labor pains, and a quivering of the nerve endings, anticipatory, for prolonged periods, the feeling of being on the verge of orgasm without any contact at all. These things occurred all 3 times, otherwise all have been different. Take it again? Oh, probably someday. but no urgency, no desire to run to my friendly corner pusher. I think the best way is to take it with a lover, but someone you're willing to have live in your head for a long, long time. Not too many of those around. It's a closeness not easily dismissed. All. Enough, I hope. About 1 p.m., the phone starts ringing in Romney's apartment, waking him up. Romney, you guys ought to be shot. 7 people committed. Freaked out. Atrocity. And finally, one from the L.A. police. Are you Romney? Listen, we got some two-tone dude down here. Oh, the dimensional Cremo. That would be Paul Foster. 400, 500, 600 people had been in that madhouse all night long, having a goddamned orgy for themselves, and the cops couldn't lay a hand on them. So, in the sour milk L.A. sunlight of 9 a.m., they had seen this gangling character rocking away from the building like a druid, half his face gold, the other half silver. So they busted the mother for being, well, drunk in public or something equally likely. But by 1 p.m. they wished to hell somebody would pick up this two-tone dude. Christ, man, it's too much for us even. We wash our hands of this atrocity. What exactly have we done? And even to some pranksters, the anti-Babs faction, the test was a debacle. They doubted the ethics of springing the acid in the Kool-Aid on the one hand, and thought the treatment of the Who Cares girl piping her freak out over the speakers was cruel. Shortly after they got back to L.A. from La Jolla, the schism broke out true and rife out front. This was a great little morbio inferiore all its own, the Life magazine divide. The Watts test in L.A., coming on top of the Trips Festival in San Francisco, had caused the fast-rising psychedelic thing to explode right out of the underground in a way nobody had dreamed of. Leary and Alpert and their experiments had had plenty of publicity, but that seemed like a fairly isolated thing, with a couple of Harvard docs at the helm and being pretty solemn-faced and esoteric about it all in all. This new San Francisco L.A. LSD thing, with whacked-out kids and delirious rock and roll, made it seem like the dread LSD had caught on like an infection among the youth, which in fact it had. Very few realized that it had all emanated from one electric source, Kesey and the Merry Pranksters. A team from Life magazine turned up, led by a photographer, Larry Schiller, who was onto the LSD world and had taken the pictures at the Hollywood test. They interviewed the pranksters and took pictures and said they were going to do a big spread on the acid scene and, they hoped, put the pranksters on the cover. So they hailed the bus on over to a big photo studio and Schiller convened them all. Then, Babs refused to go in. But the rest of them, Norman, Hagen, Cassidy, a whole flock of them went on in, and Schiller took a lot of pictures. To Norman it seemed square. For one thing, the guy was working in black and white, and the most obvious thing about the pranksters was color, day-glow, the brighter the better, the more vibrations the better. Then Schiller had them all sit down in a group against a black background, and in the middle they had Cassidy stand up and wave his arms up and down like a crow. He took the pictures in strobe, and this would make Cassidy look like he had multi-arms like the great god Shiva. This strobe thing was at the time new in psychedelic photography, and the mass media would never tire of it. Recreates the acid experience, etc. Ben Schiller told certain people to stay around for individual shots, colorful characters like Cassidy, and Paul Foster with his wild mutton chops and importancy coat, and Norman, maybe because he had a beard. The usual. The others went on outside where Babs was. Finally, they all left, the ones who had stayed for the individual shots, and when they got outside, the bus was gone. Clean gone. Babs, Mountain Girl, Zonker, Walker, and the others. Split. Hagen couldn't believe it. Why, we've been pranked, he said. Pranksters. And the pranked. Things being like they were to begin with, the prank took on fundamental meaning. Those who got pranked finally made their way back to the moldering Sanssouci, and Babs and company had cleared out of there, too, taking all the money and the food. Babs left word that they, the inner nucleus, were going off to hold a test of their own and would rejoin the satellites for the UCLA acid test, scheduled for March 19th. The great idea still kept us together. And Norman, Cassidy, Hagen, Paul Foster, Roy Seaburn, Marge, and a couple of others made a stab at preparing for the UCLA test. But UCLA backed out of the deal because of the notoriety after the Watts test, and that did it. All began drifting off. It was a strange time and a strange feeling. Nobody could figure why Babs had pranked Cassidy. The others, maybe. Although that Hagen would get pranked was pretty strange, too. But Cassidy, that was unbelievable. Cassidy said fuck it and headed for San Francisco. Norman and Paul Foster went to stay at Hugh Romney's. Then, by and by, Norman got a chance to go to New York with Marge the Barge and Evan Engber, so they headed east by car. Hardly had Leo left us when faith and concord amongst us was at an end. It was as if the lifeblood of our group flowed away from an invisible wound. One day Paul Foster cranked up the Great God Rotor and sat down and worked on a very intricate illuminated billhead. When he got through, there was an ornate black border, and in the middle the words, In Memoriam, in florid old English lettering, and at the bottom, January 23rd, 1966, the day Kesey disappeared. Nothing else, just In Memoriam and the date. He hung it up on the wall. Chapter 21 The Fugitive. All ask easy, move, scram, split, flee, hide, vanish, disintegrate, like run. Rev, 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 rev. Or are we going to have just a late, late Mexican rerun of the scene on the rooftop in San Francisco and sit here with the motor spinning and watch with fascination while the cops, they climb up once again to come get you? They just opened the door down below, Rotor Rooter, so you have maybe 45 seconds, assuming they be slow and sneaky and sure about it. Kesey sits in a little upper room in the last house down the beach, $80 a month, on Paradise Blue Banderillas Bay in Puerto Vallarta, on the west coast of Mexico, state of Jalisco, one step from the floppy green fronds of the jungle, wherein flourish lush, steamy baboon lusts of paranoia. Kesey sits in this little rickety upper room with his elbow on a table and his forearm standing up perpendicular, and in the palm of his hand a little mirror, so that his forearm and the mirror are like a big rear-view mirror stanchion on the side of a truck, and thus he can look out the window and see them, but they can't see him. Come on, man, you need a copy of the script to see how this movie goes. You have maybe 40 seconds left before they come get you. A Volkswagen has been cruising up and down the street for no earthly reason at all, except that they are obviously working with the fake telephone linesman outside the window who whistle. There they go again. Whistle in the slow-brained, brown Mexican Huarache day laborer way, for no earthly reason except that they are obviously finked in with the Volkswagen. Now a tan sedan comes along the street, minus a license plate, but plus a stenciled white number, exactly like a prison stencil, police and two coatless guys inside, both in white shirts, so they're not prisoners. One turned, looked back. If you were watching all this on a movie screen, you know what your reaction would be through a mouthful of popcorn from the third row. What more do you need, you dolt? Scram out of there! But he has just hooked down 5 dexedrines and the old motor is spinning and rushing most nice and euphorically in fascination. And a man can't depart this nice $80-a-month snug harbor on Paradise Blue Banderillas Bay just yet with a cool creak of speed rush in his veins. It is such a tiny little think scene as he sees it in the hand mirror. He can tilt it and see his own face entropied with the strain and then tilt it. A sign, a sparrow, fat and sleek, dive through the dwindling sun into a hole in one of the lampposts. Home. More telefono trucks. 2 loud whistles this time, for no earthly reason except to come get you. You have maybe 35 seconds left. Kesey has Cornell Wilde running jacket ready, hanging on the wall. A Jungle Jim corduroy jacket stashed with fishing line, a knife, money, DDT, tablet, ballpoints, flashlight, and grass. As it timed by test runs that he can be out the window, down through a hole in the roof below, down a drain pipe, over a wall and into thickest jungle in 45 seconds. Well, only 35 seconds left, but head start is all that's needed with the element of surprise. Besides, it's so fascinating to be here in subastral projection with the cool rushing decks, synced into their minds and his own, in all its surges and tributaries and convolutions, turning it this way and that, and rationalizing the situation for the 100th time in split seconds, such as, if they have that many men already here, the phony telephone men, the cops in the tan car, the cops in the Volkswagen, what are they waiting for? Why haven't they crashed right in through the rotten doors of this rat building? But he gets the signal even before he finishes the question. Waiting. They know they've got you, fool, have known for weeks. But they're certain you're connected with all the LSD being smuggled up from Mexico, and they want to take in as big a haul as possible when they finally slam it. Like Leary. They must have been watching a dreadful long time before they were content they had him on something worth his size. 30 years. For a Harvard doctor with grass. That's how bad they wanted the whole business locked away. That's how dangerous they consider the whole business. And they were completely correct, if not in their fantasy, then at least in their evaluation of the present and ever-growing psychedelic threat. A noise down below. Them? 30 segundos left? Maybe it's Black Mariah come back with good things for eating and stuff for the new disguise. Steve Lamb, mild-mannered reporter and all-around creep. Run, fool! Shh! Such a quiet, secret, muffled smile will be on Black Mariah's face. It could have been all so quiet, just him and Zonker and the smoldering Black Mariah in this $80-a-month paradise Blue Banderias Bay in Puerto Vallarta. If the suicide ruse and the rest of the main fugitive fantasy had but worked. The trip into Mexico was easy because everything with Boise was easy. Boise always knew. They picked up Zonker in L.A. and then Jim Fish, and they coasted on over the line at Tijuana. No hassle to cross over into Mexico. The border at Tijuana is like a huge superhighway toll station, a huge concrete apron, and 10 or 15 customs booths in a row for all the cars pouring over into Tijuana from San Diego and points north. All plastic green and concrete like part of suburban superhighway America. So they rolled on over the line with Kesey hidden in the back of Boise's old panel truck and heart don't even thump too bad. Spirits up a little of the prankster Elan back in the cosmos. In true prankster fashion, they spent one-third their money stash on a Madman Munts auto stereo rig to go along with all the other valuables like tape recorders and many tapes. The next likely hassle is visas because this shapes up as a long stay. Might be hot to try to get Kesey one in Tijuana, because Tijuana is just a California annex, really, the slums of San Diego. And they just might very well know about the case. We'll do it in Sonoyta, man, says Boise. They don't give a shit there. Put down a couple of bucks and they can't see anything else. Sonoyta is almost due east of Tijuana, just south of the Arizona border. Kesey uses his good chuck ID there and all is Jake in Sonoyta. Fugitive, real life and for sure now. Then south, down so-called Route 2 and so-called Route 15, bouncing and grinding along through the brown dust and scrawny chickens and animal dung, brown dust fumes of western Mexico, towns of Coyote, Caborca, Santa Ana, Querobabi, Cornelio, Aloysius, he, Hermosillo, ha, Positos Casas, Cieneguito, Guaymas, Camastli, Miscoatl, Tlazolteotl, Quetzalcoatl, Huitzilopochtli, Tezcatlipoca, haunting the Dairy Queen Rat Queen crossroads in the guise of a rat, a Popolhuactli screeing rat, Tezocotl, Yautl, Titlacahuan, he whose slaves we are, Ocpaniitzo, priesty angel freaked out in a motorcycle made from the Vaseline skin of gangbang girl meets white trash, a confetti of skulls and death in western Mexico, the ratlands. Not one inch of it is picturesque burros and shawls or Nova Zapata hats or color TV pink chunks of watermelon or water lilies or gold feathers or long eyelashes or high combs or tortillas and tacos and chili powder or fluticamote vendors or muletas or toreros or olés or mariachi bands or water lilies or blood of the dahlia or tinny cantinas or serapis or movie Black Mariahs with shiny black hair and steaming little high round pubescent bottoms. None of the old Mexico we know and love on the 21-day excursion fare. Just the boogering brown dust and bloated rat corpses by the road, goats, cows, chickens with all 4 feet up in the air at the Tezcatlipocan skull-rot crossroads of Mexico. To Kesey it was a hopeless, flea-bitten desert he was fleeing into. But Boise made it bearable. Boise always knew. Boise was wizened and thin-faced, and he had the awfulest New England high flat whine. And he didn't belong anywhere near here, but he was here now, and he knew. The truck breaks down for the 14th time. No hassle, man. We just back it up on a rock, man. Then we just take the tire off and fix it. More flat rat country, mosquito and flea, into total nothing, like the lines of perspective in a surrealist painting. But Boise makes you realize it is all the same, here as anywhere. Boise lecherously scanning the streets as they bounce through the dead chicken towns, just like it was only Saturday night on Broadway in North Beach, spotting a good-looking gringa muchacha padding along the side of the road with honest calves. 25 seconds left, fool. And he says, shall we get her over and ball her, man? All in the same New England whine, as if he were saying, want a Coke or not? Kesey looks at Boise's lined face, and his thin lips looks ancient. Only a glitter comes out of the eyes, nice and lecherous, dead certain and crazy alive at the same time. And Boise in that moment is in the tiny knot of perfect pranksters, the inner circle, ascending into the Sangha for good. In Guaymas, on the Gulf, Jim Fish wants out. An early attack of paranoia, Jim Fish? And catches a bus back to the U.S., leaving Kesey, Boise, and Zonker and the equipment. But was it not ever so? You're either on the bus or off the bus. Kesey's spirits were picking up. Boise was pulling everything together. This crazy New Englander is here in these ratlands. Hey, man, Boise points at a construction scene they're going by. See that? As if to say, there's the whole thing right there. A whole gang of workmen are trying to put the stucco on the ceiling of a building they're finishing up. One fat man is mixing up the stucco in a wash tub. One skinny one is scooping the stucco up out of the tub with a little trowel and pitching it up underhanded at the ceiling. A little of it sticks, and three or four guys stand on a plank scaffolding, taking stabs at smoothing it out. But most of it falls down on the floor, and three or four more are hunkered down there, scraping it up off the floor and shoveling it back in the tub, and the skinny guy skinnies up another little gob with his skinny trowel, and they all stare again to see what happens. They are all hunkering around in huaraches, worthless, flat, rat-woven sandals, up on the scaffolding, down on the floor, waiting to see what happens, how fate brings it off with this little gob of nothing pitched up at the rat expense. And it's all there, the whole Mexico trip. They have a saying, "Hay tiempo." Boise hooks the steering wheel to get around an ice cream vendor in the middle of the road. Oh, there is time. 20 seconds, idiot. Huaraches, which are the rat shoe. It all sinks. Mexico is the rat paradise. But of course, it is not worthless, it is perfection. It is as if all the rat things of all the rat lands of America, all the drive-ins, mobile home parks, Dairy Queens, Superettes, Sunset Strips, auto accessory stores, septic tank developments, souvenir shops, snack bars, layaway furniture stores, the Venator living rooms, hot plate hotels, bus station paperback racks, luncheonette in the booth jukebox slots, raw concrete service station toilets with a head of urine in the bowl, Greyhound bus toilets with paper towels and vomit hanging over the hockey puck black rim, Army-Navy stores with bikini codpiece briefs for men, super giant racks with matching green twill shirts and balloon bottom pants for honest toilers. $8,000 bungalows with plastic accordion folding partitions and the baby asleep in there in a fold-away crib of plastic net. Picnic tables with the benches built onto them used in the dining room. Johnny Trot barbecue sandwiches with a carbonated fruit drink. Aluminum slat awnings, aluminum sidings. Lukewarm coffee with in a china mug with a pale brown pool in the saucer and a few ashes. A spade counter chef scraping a short order grill with a chalky kitschy brick, and he won't take your order till he's through. A first-come, first-served doctor's waiting room with modest charwomen with their dresses stuck on the seats of shiny vinyl chairs, and they won't move to get loose for fear you'll look up their dress. Plaid car coats from Sears and a canvas cap with a bill. Synthetic dresses for waitresses looking like milky cellophane. Rat cones, rat sodas, rat meat salad sandwiches, rat cheesies, rat burgers. It is as if all the rat things of all the rat lands of America had been looking for their country, their Canaan, their Israel, and they found it in Mexico. It has its own rat aesthetics. It's hulking beautiful. Then they reached Mazatlan. The first full-fledged resort you reach on the west coast of Mexico coming down from the States. Everybody's trip was fishing in Mazatlan. Along the old Avenida del Mar and the Paseo Clausen, white walls with nice artistic rat fishing scenes and hotel archways with great shiny blue marlins hanging inside the arches, and gringos with duckbill caps here to catch me some marlin. Mariachi music at last, with the trumpets always breaking and dropping off the note and then struggling up again. Zonker has the bright idea of going to O'Brien's bar on the beachfront, place he got beat up out back of once by 13 Mexican fags. Zonker enjoys revisiting scenes of previous debacles. Like also spends hours on the beach telling them how his true and fiercest fear is of being attacked by a shark while swimming, as he picks flea bite scabs until his legs stream blood to the luscious world, then goes swimming. O'Brien's brings on the paranoia right away. It is a break in the rat movie. It is dark and a Mexican band plays, signaling to the rat sensibility that it will cost too much. Rat souls everywhere fear dark, picturesque restaurant, knowing instinctively they will pay dearly for the bullshit ambiance, dollar a drink, probably. O'Brien's was crowded, and then through the cocktail gloom, heads. A bunch of kids with the Jesus Christ hair, the temple bells and donkey beads, serape vests, mandalas. In short, American heads. Zonker recognizes them immediately. They're not only American heads, but from San Jose, and some had been to the acid tests. Just what the fugitive needs to blow the whole suicide ruse. Guess who I saw in Mexico? Naturally, Zonk, with his zest for debacle, hails them over. Keezy is introduced as Joe, and nobody pays him much mind except for one dark little girl, Mexican-looking, with long black hair. "When were you born?" she says to Keezy. She doesn't sound Mexican. She sounds like Lauren Bacall speaking through a tube. "I'm a Virgo." No sense hitting a ball three hits you can see coming if you can cut across the fourth. "I thought so. I'm a Scorpio." "Beautiful." The black Scorpio obviously knows Zonk best. She knows him when. But Zonk belongs to the ages, and it comes to pass that Zonk or no Zonk, she and Keezy relax out in the open air on the pier one night, down by a Mazatlan rat beach, all dirt and scrabble. But the waves and the wind and the harbor lights do it upright, and the moon hits some kind of concrete shaft there, putting her in the dark, in the shadow, and him in the light, lit up by the moon, as if some designer drew a line precisely between their bodies. Black Mariah, he decides. So Black Mariah joins the fugitive band, and they go off to Puerto Vallarta. Puerto Vallarta is out of the Ratlands. All picture book Mexico. Paradise blue Banderillas Bay and a pure white beach and white Latino cottages right up against the jungle, which is a deep, raw green and clean. Fat green fronds lapping up against the back of the houses on the beach. Macaw sounds, or very near it. Secret poisonous orchid and orange pops and petals winking out when the foliage moves. A nice romantic gothic jungle. Zonker hassles with an oily little real estate man and gets the last house on the edge of town for $80 a month. The rent is low because the jungle is too close for the tourists, the jungle and too many Mexican kids and chickens and the rural dung dust. Boise heads back to the U.S., and Keezy, Zonker, and Black Mariah move in. They have the upper half of the house, one floor and a spiral staircase up to the roof. Up on the roof is a kind of thatched hut, the highest perch around, a perfect lookout post and a snug harbor. Keezy decides to risk a phone call to the States to let Faye and everybody know he's okay. He goes into town and calls Peter Demma in the hip pocket bookstore in Santa Cruz. A little metallic clanking about by the telefonista señoritas down at Central. And then, "Peter?" From many rat miles away, "Ken." Very surprised, naturally. So Keezy whiled the time sitting in the snug hacienda on the edge of Puerto Vallarta, sipping beer and smoking many joints and writing in a notebook occasionally. He wanted to get a little of all this down and send it to Larry McMurtry. "Larry, phone calls to the States, $8 apiece. Besides, was ever a good board to bound my favorite ball of bullshit prose often, it was you. Like all about Black Mariah. In many ways, she is so great. She is quiet and has a kind of broody beauty. She cooks. She looks Mex and speaks Mex. She can even hassle Mex. She sounds out the mayor of Puerto Vallarta as to how safe Keezy will be here in town. Hay tiempo, he says. The extradition takes forever. Very nice to know." And yet Black Mariah is not completely a prankster. She wants to be a part of all this. She wants to do this thing, but she does it without belief. It is like the Mexican part of her Black Mariah thing. She has all the trappings of Mexican. She looks it. She speaks it. Her grandfather was even Mexican. But she is not Mexican. She is Carolyn Hanna of San Jose, California, under everything else, even the blood. He wrote in the notebook, "Moving the dark Indian. 10 seconds left, you freaking idiot!" Body out of the Indian land weakened the Indian blood with chicken soup and matzo balls. So much of the fire concealed by the dark and broody beauty lies just that deep, because she does it without belief. And yet it is very nice up here in this thatched perch atop the last house. A car heads up the street, Zonker and Black Mariah coming back to the house. He peers over the edge at the car kicking up the dust, then writes in the notebook, "It is a perfect lookout, allowing me to see them without them seeing me. Many things sink." Zonker and Black Mariah drove down the road, scattering up the kids and the chickens and the dust, and Black Mariah pointed up to the top of the house and said to Zonker, "Look, there's Keezy." Then she looked out the window and stared at the jungle. "I bet he thinks we can't see him." The jig is up. Zonker brings a telegram from Paul Robertson back in San Jose, and it is a bear. It is not even a warning. It... 5 seconds. 5 seconds left. "You really just gonna sit there for the squash?" is final. "The jig is up," it says. Meaning, it turned out, that the suicide ruse had been exposed and the cops knew he was in Puerto Vallarta. Exposed? Hell, the suicide prank had turned into a goddamn comic opera. For a start, Dee had pulled a sort of Dee out, as Mountain Girl feared. Dee had driven up looking for a cliff near Humboldt Bay, about 250 miles north of San Francisco, up near Eureka, California, not far from the Oregon border in Redwoods country. He got up to the last hill going up there, and the panel truck wouldn't pull the hill. So he called into town for a tow truck, and the garage man and the tow truck pulled the suicide vehicle up the last mile. Hired and paid for, and thanks a lot. Always nice to hire some help to commit suicide. Next, Dee dropped Keezy's distinctive sky-blue boots down to the shore below, but they hit the water instead and sank without a bubble. Next, the goddamned romantic suicide desolate foaming cliff was so goddamned desolate nobody noticed the truck for about 2 weeks, despite the Ira Sand Pearl for President sign on the rear bumper. Apparently, people figured the old heap had been abandoned. The Humboldt County Police finally checked it out on February 11th. Next, the suicide note, which seemed so ineluctably convincing as Keezy and Mountain Girl smoked a few joints and soared into passages of Shelley and Weltschmerz, it gave off a giddy scent of put-on, even to the straight cops of the Humboldt. There were certain inconsistencies, like the part about the truck smashing into a redwood. Well, even in the D-out, D couldn't exactly ask the tow truck man, "Well, now that you've towed it up here, how about jamming it into a tree for me?" Next, the late happy call to Peter Demma in Santa Cruz. Demma had really been bowled over to hear from Keezy. A lot of people who liked him, had really been worried that he was dead. And now here was Keezy calling him, alive, with a message for Faye in the whole thing. That was Saturday. The next night, Sunday, February 13th, Demma dropped into Manuel's Mexican restaurant in Santa Cruz, and there was his old friend Bob Levy. By way of making conversation, Levy says, "What have you heard from Ken?" "I just got a call from him," says Demma, "from Puerto Vallarta." "That's interesting." Levy happens to be a reporter for the Watsonville Register Pajaronian, Watsonville being a town near Santa Cruz. The next afternoon, Monday, the lead story in the Watsonville Register Pajaronian carries a 5-column headline reading, "Missing Novelist Turns Up in Mexico." The next day, Tuesday, the San Jose Mercury picked up the story and put a little more spin on it with a story headlined, "Keezy's Corpse Having a Ball in Puerto Vallarta." 2 seconds, O corpse of mine. That's no Black Mariah shuffling up the stairs outside. The door dolt. It's a cop clump up the stairs. No earthly sound like it. Sharp whistle from the telefonistas. VW backing down the street. This is truly it. Truly it. Grab the Cornell Wild running jacket, fool. Make the brain catch cold. Rev, 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 spinning, and in the giant pyramidal cells of Betts of precentral, cerebral cortex, rise and heave and slip, ganglionic layer shudders and giggles, synapses light like random beetle flashbulbs. Cue, blasting out. Silly from motor homunculus, you missed your flash, O mighty masticator, salivator, vocalizer, swallower, licker, biter, sucker, brow knitter, looker, blinker, rubber necker, thumber, prodder, up yours, fingerer, ring-wearer, nose-picker, waver, drinker, arm-lifter, body-bender, hip-swiveler, knee-er, springer, runner, zero. Run! Sonbitch! The gears catch at last. He springs up, grabs Cornell Wilde's jacket, leaps through the back window, down through the hole, down the drainpipe. Now vault the wall, you mother, into the jungle, Floppy. Araman! What's that? His head is down, but he can see it. What's that? Up there in the window he just jumped out of. Brown. He can feel it. There is a vibration on the parasympathetic efferent fibers behind the eyeballs, and it hums, Raman. Two of them. One brown dumpy mech with gold handle butt gun. One crew-cut American FBI body snatcher watching him flying like a monkey over the wall into the jungle. The brown mech holds gold gun, but the brain behind that face too brown, moldering mech's earth to worry about, couldn't hit a peeing dog. Plunge into the lapping PV fronds, bursting orchid and orange the motor, homunculus, working perfect, now powerful, gallop into the picture book jungles of Mexico. A moment later, Black Mariah walked into the apartment. She found Kesey gone and the Cornell Wilde jungle running jacket gone. That trip again. Well, he'll come back when he's ready to, worn out, and things will be cool for a while. Kesey had gotten paranoid as hell, but that wasn't the only thing. He liked this fugitive game. Man, he'd scram out in the jungle and hide out there for 2 or 3 days and smoke a lot of grass and finally straggle in. That started before the telegram, even. There was a whole signal they worked out. Or he worked out. When the coast was clear, she was supposed to hang up a yellow shirt of Zonk's on the line outside the back window, facing the jungle. It was a yellow shirt with a black and brown print on it, on the faggy side, if you asked Black Mariah. The flag would go up, and finally Kesey would straggle back home beat, having run himself about to death in the jungle or along the beach. And yet it was nice. It was crazy, but nice. Kesey was the most magnetic person she had ever met. He radiated something, a kind of power. His thoughts, the things he talked about, were very complex and metaphysical and cryptic, but his manner was back home, almost back country. Even while he was reeking with paranoia, he seemed to have total confidence. That was very strange. He could make you feel like part of something very... He had even given her a new name, Black Mariah. She was Black Mariah. As a girl in San Jose, California, she had felt like everything she really was had been smothered under layers and layers of games she couldn't control. Externally, there was nothing wrong. Her father and mother were both teachers, and life in San Jose was comfortable and serene in the California suburban manner. But half the time nobody ever understands about growing up in this country. Little penguin islands full of kids playing Lord of the Flies, a world of pygmy tribes invisible to the Isfahan adult eye. These little devils, tribes of studs, tribes of rakes, tribes of intel finks even, tribes of greasers, and an amorphous mass of hopeless cases left over. Until psychedelics started around there, mainly grass and acid. The new scene started, and suddenly all sorts of, well, beautiful people blossomed forth from out of the polyglot, people who really had a lot to them, only it had been smothered by all the eternal social games that had been set up. Suddenly they found each other. One night she was high and experienced the unity, the all-one. A light was behind her in the room and hit her body from behind and broke up into beams and shone out before her, hitting the floor and the walls in spokes of light with shadows in between. The room broke up before her eyes and separated in just that pattern with bars of light vibrating. Suddenly it became very clear, the way the room was put together, the way the parts fit, the way the parts of everything fit, as if someone had taken an Indian puzzle ring apart for her. It was clear how everything fit together, and it wasn't really a world split up into pointless games and cliques. That was merely the way it looked before you knew the key. And now there were beautiful people who knew the key, and this experience could be shared. Her mother gave her money for the second semester at San Jose State, and although it hurt her mother at first, she knew what she had to do. She took the money and headed off to Mexico with some beautiful kids. It was a little more complicated than that. She knew Zonk at San Jose State, and she knew he was heading for Mexico, for Mazatlan, although she didn't know about the Kesey prank, and so she was following Zonk, for if there were beautiful people, Zonk was one of them. Mazatlan was just beginning to be the acid head's favorite spot on the Mexican West Coast. It wasn't a place the real hardcore tourists were onto yet. They went on down the coast to Acapulco, generally. At the same time, Mazatlan wasn't so unbearably Mexicali, sad. Like the true acid central of Mexico, Ajijic on Lake Chapala. Those poor, sad Lake Chapala villages, Ajijic, Chapala, Ocotepec, with the lake drying up and the old suck-smack lily pad scum mud showing and failed American aesthetes padding around earnestly in sandals, 48-year-old bohos sucking up to young heads of the new generation of hip. Very sad. It is truly a sad thing when an American boho says, fuck this, and picks up and leaves this fucking tail fin and shopping plaza and war-crazy civilization, and goes to live among real people, the honest folk-type folk, in the land of earth feelings, Mexico. And the hell with tile baths. And then he sits there, in Mexico, amid the hunkering hard-cheese mestizos, and, man, it is honest and real here, and just as miserable as hell. And he is a miserable, aging fuck-up with no place else to go.